An individual has not started living until they can rise above the narrow confines of their individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity. Yeah, I quite like this quote by Dr. Martin Luther King. I want to say it's very Buddhist, but really it's not Buddhist. It's actually universal. Because it's kind of interesting, when you think about Buddhist truth, there is no such thing as Buddhist truth. If something is true, it is true at all times and under all conditions, and it doesn't have to be Buddhist or Christian or Catholic. Or truth transcends. So this quote by Dr. Martin Luther King, it's certainly Buddhistic, is perhaps a good way to say it. An individual has not started to live until they can rise above the narrow confines of their individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity. Yeah, so I recently started reading Radical Dharma by Kyoto Angel Williams. It's a book about race and love and the Dharma. And she speaks about this notion of belonging. Well, it's not a notion. It's actually something we all deeply yearn for, you know, a sense of belonging. So those of us who act upon that desire to find a sense of belonging will go out and try and meet people. We'll try and find our people, our peeps, our community. If we like to knit, maybe we'll go to a knitting meetup. I don't know if there's such a thing in the age of pandemic. but we'll tend to go find like-minded people. Oh, well, what do I like to do? Well, maybe I'll go find other people who like to do that too. And then we can all become friends. Yeah. And then I'll have this sense of belonging. But it's interesting because belonging, if it's taken in this kind of narrow, individualistic sense that Martin Luther King is speaking about, the sense of belonging can very much become simply tribalism. So instead of me, myself, and I against the big bad world, tribalism simply becomes, these are my peeps, this is my community, this is my tribe. So it's no longer me against the world. It then quickly becomes, or it can quickly become, us against the world. And I think it's very interesting to actually explore this notion of tribalism, because I think it's very clear that this exploration of race, that I'm sure is on the fore of many of our minds, that when we look at the people around us, I know when I do this, I'll just speak for myself, when I look at the people around me, my circle of friends, there's definitely a like-mindedness that I see. It's also interesting to notice what I do not see. You know, what is absent from this picture? So I certainly notice that there's an absence of diversity, or a lack of. It's not an absence of. I would like to see more. And the fact that I don't says something to me. It informs me around my relationship to tribalism. So I certainly consider the San Francisco Buddhist Center community to be my spiritual home. And I certainly feel a sense of belonging. But that sense of belonging is very preferential. So the sense of Dr. Martin Luther King speaks about, the narrow confines of one's individualistic concerns. So tribalism is just simply the narrow confines of our collective concerns. And what Dr. Martin Luther King is inviting us to do is to expand that sphere of concern, that sense of belonging, to the broader concerns of all humanity. So this is a very big word, all. all humanity. It doesn't say the broader concerns of the humans we like. It says all humanity. So the people we like, the people we don't like, the people we don't know, we don't care about, it's all humanity. And that's a very tall order. And it actually goes against the grain of how we are by default in the world. You know, by default, we're very self-centered beings. We're concerned primarily about our own happiness, getting what we want and getting away from what we don't want. So you can even notice this within your community, within your tribe. So within your tribe, do you like everyone equally? Or do you move towards the people you like and you move away from the people you don't like? I know that that's what I do. I imagine most people do that. It's perfectly normal. It's perfectly natural, it feels like. So why is this a problem? Like, what's so wrong with that? Why do I need to concern myself with the broader concerns of all humanity? That seems really hard. I don't even think I'm up for it. I'm not even sure what that means. How do you do that? How do you care for all of humanity? Well, first of all, let me respond to why this is a problem. Why the narrow confines of our individualistic concerns are a problem. So I'm going to do this with a story, with an image. And this image comes from a Buddhist nun. Her name is Pema Chodron. All I've got to say about Pema Chodron is I love Pema Chodron. So she teaches this story, this image of the perfect room. And I imagine some of you may have heard me tell this story before because I love to tell it. And I will continue to tell it because it's such a wonderful story. So this is Pema Chodron's perfect room. So imagine the perfect room. And it's not any random perfect room. It's the perfect room for you. It is your perfect room. So in this perfect room, it's got your favorite artwork, original artwork. It's got your favorite style of furniture. Maybe it's Art Deco or Victorian or whatever it may be. It's got your favorite furniture, a beautiful Persian rug, whatever it may be. The temperature is perfect for you. The kitchen is filled with your favorite foods. The music that's playing is your favorite music. And the only people you let into your perfect room are people who totally get you, right? They're totally on your wavelength, right? They're your people. So this room is perfect for you. It might not be perfect for other people, but for you, it's just perfect. Mm. So one day, you get a craving for your mom's matzo ball soup. And you know this restaurant that makes it just like your mom used to make it. And for whatever reason, this restaurant doesn't deliver. So the only way you can get this matzo ball soup is to actually leave your perfect room and go to this restaurant. So you go outside, and as you're walking to this restaurant, you see sights that you don't like. Maybe they scare you. You smell smells that are unpleasant. Oh. There's lots of people. Oh, who are all these people? I don't like these people. So you quickly kind of get quite anxious and quite scared. You feel unsafe, unsettled. So you walk as quickly as you can to the restaurant. You get your matzo ball soup and you go rushing back to your perfect room. And when you get there, you quickly shut the door, put the deadbolts on. Maybe you jam a towel underneath the crack in the door. And the floor to keep out all those nasty smells that you smelled. Maybe you draw the curtains to keep out all those sights that you don't want to see. And very quickly, this perfect room, it becomes a prison. So that's the image of the perfect room. So to be immersed in the narrow confines of our individualistic concerns, what's behind this is control. What's behind this is the desire to control my environment, my experience, such that it only includes the things I like and it excludes the things I don't like. So from a Buddhist standpoint, this is most definitely a strategy that is doomed to fail, because there are many, many things in this world that we have absolutely no control over. To name some obvious things, old age, sickness, and death. We have no control over these things. But then in terms of people, other people, we really have no control over other people. So this notion of engaging with the broader concerns of all humanity, it's like, oh, people, people, people. It's a very tall order. So from a Buddhist standpoint, the reason it's so important to move out of our individualistic concerns and into a broader concern of all humanity is because from a Buddhist standpoint, this notion of it's all about me and what I want, what I like, what I don't like, it's all about me, that this all about me tendency is actually the root of our suffering. So what we are being invited to do by Dr. Martin Luther King and also by the Buddha, it is to cultivate a sense of belonging with all beings, without prejudice, without discrimination, without judgment. All beings. And in order to do this, we actually have to open up our hearts to include more. And particularly, we have to include the things which we tend to exclude. And those things we tend to exclude tend to be things that make us uncomfortable or that confuse us. So it's very interesting bringing that perspective to what's going on in the world right now in regards to systemic racism, in regards to, you know, for me personally, the lack of black people in my life. So including more. Yeah, so what I'd like to suggest is it's almost 8 o'clock now, so I think it's time for a little tea break. What I'd like to invite everyone to do is to think of this tea break as a little time for reflection. So to bring in a meditative quality into your tea break. Whatever you do, bring mindfulness to it. So if you want to get yourself a cup of tea or use the bathroom, just bring some mindfulness to that. And as you're taking your break, I'd just like to ask you to turn this question over in your mind. How can I include more in my awareness? How can I broaden my sense of care for myself to include more people? So please give that some thought. And then after the tea break, we'll have an opportunity to just share whatever came up with regards to that reflection. How can I open my heart, open my mind to include more? All right. So let's take about a 10-minute tea break. So why don't we return at about 8:10? Okay, well, welcome back, everyone. Okay, so let's see. We got about half hour left. So I'd like to return to the theme of the of our month of July at Song and I, which is Prasada Chitta and I are sharing stories from the or teachings from the Pali Canon. So the Pali Canon is the written record of the teachings of the Buddha. And what Prasada Chitta and I decided to do was not only to share teachings from the Pali Canon, but then to pick teachings that are relevant to what's going on in the here and now, and in response to everything that's arisen since the killing of George Floyd. So I like to think of the month of July as, the title of the series is, In Response to the Killing of George Floyd, What Would Buddha Do? So I had a really interesting conversation with Prasada Chitta about this, because we were talking about this notion of the teachings of the from the Buddha that are recorded in the Pali Canon, that these teachings, these truths that are being pointed towards, if they're really ultimately true, then they should be true at all times. So there's a universal truth that's being communicated by the Buddha. And we can take that universal truth and apply it specifically to our current situation. So what I'd like to do is kind of start at this universal level, if you will. Here's what the Buddha teaches. And then relate that to the present. Right. So what would Buddha do? So to just to quickly recap, on week one, I gave a talk about perception and how our perception is distorted by greed, hatred, and delusion. So one very good example is during the Metta Bhavana, when we all brought a difficult person to mind. I know for me that when I bring a difficult person to mind, it's not just physical sensations and emotions that arise. There's also a narrative that arises about why I find this person frustrating. And what happens with this narrative is it comes to the fore. And any good qualities about this person recede to the background. So my experience of aversion, it distorts my perception, where I more heavily weight certain aspects of my experience, and I tend to ignore other aspects of my experience. And we could say that racism arises through distorted perception, through perception that is distorted by greed, hatred, and delusion. So I'll say more about that later. And then on week two, which was last week, Prasada Chitta shared one of the suttas from the Pali Canon called the Salaka Sutta. And it's commonly translated as self-effacement. And this word effacement, I didn't know what this word meant, so I had to look it up. So effacement means to rub away, to eliminate, to destroy, to efface something, to remove something. So self-effacement really means to remove the self. Now, of course, that raises all sorts of questions, right, which I will get into a little bit. In this Salaka Sutta, the Buddha gives these pairs of, it's not really a pair, it's more like it's a negative mental state or a mental impurity, and then it's juxtaposed by not doing that particular thing. So for example, others in the world will speak harshly, we will not speak harshly. So the Salaka Sutta goes through 44 different mental and emotional impurities, and the instruction there is to refrain from those. And Prasada Chitta added his own pairings in relationship to the modern, to our modern time, to our current situation. And I'll just repeat the ones that he added. Others will ignore the plight of the oppressed. We will not ignore the plight of the oppressed. Others will fail to learn about the oppressions and injustices of the past. We will not fail to learn about the oppressions and injustices of the past. Others will be defensive when their unearned privileges are challenged. We will not be defensive when our unearned privileges are challenged. Okay, so now moving into week 3. So to take this teaching of self-effacement, I'd actually like to use this sutta and say a bit more about it before moving to some other suttas. Self-effacement. So what exactly is being pointed at here? Well, I'd actually like to read a few sentences from this sutta, from the Salaika Sutta that Prasadachitta shared with us last week. So in case you weren't here, like the setup for this sutta is a monk comes to visit the Buddha and asks him a question. And the question is something like, well, I'm practicing with a lot of other monks, and they are entering into states of concentration, and I'm wondering if they are over-assessing themselves in terms of their accomplishment. So that's the setup. So the person who's asking the questions to the Buddha is Chunda, and this is the Buddha's response. Chunda, as to those various views that arise in the world associated either with doctrines of a self or with doctrines about the world, when one sees with proper wisdom thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself, then the abandoning and relinquishing of those views comes about. So I'm going to say a bit about what's being pointed at here by this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And that turn of phrase, it appears repeatedly in the Pali Canon. So many suttas have this turn of phrase, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. And that is referring to this practice of self-effacement. But before I get into that, I wanted to read the next two sentences in this sutta. It is possible here, Chunda, that quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, some monk or nun enters upon and abides in the first dhyana. They might think this: I am abiding in self-effacement. But it is not these attainments that are called self-effacement in the Noble One's discipline. These are called pleasant abidings here and now in the Noble One's discipline. So the reason I read those two sections from this sutta around self-effacement is because it's pointing at something that's really, really important. So Buddhism in the West has a reputation of disengaging from the world. So the notion of a Buddhist activist. So a good friend of mine who's very politically active, he was telling me that he feels as if he has one foot in two different worlds. He's got his activist world and he's got his Buddhist world. And he's not quite sure how to bring the two together. So the danger for Buddhism is that we become simply navel gazers. We just stare at our belly buttons. We retreat off into the mountains and we bliss out in meditation and all is well. And this is here what the Buddha is talking about when he says there are monks who can dwell in states of concentration here in the first jhana, which is a very pleasant state to dwell in. And then the Buddha calls this, well, that's not actually reducing the self. That's not self-effacement. It's simply pleasant abiding in the here and now. It's a pleasant meditation. So here I'm going to name two broad categories of meditation. One is called samatha. The other one is called vipassana. So samatha, this word, it means calming. or calm, samatha. So when we are doing samatha meditation, what we're doing is we are allowing our minds to settle down and quiet down, actually, such that we can enter a state of concentration. And as that state of concentration ripens, even the internal voice in our mind, it quiets down and slows down. At least for me, it slows down. And then it actually becomes completely silent. And it's a very blissful state, if anyone has experienced dhyana before. So that's samatha practice. And the Buddha is being very clear here. He's saying that's not self-effacement, which means that's not actually addressing suffering at its root cause. And what's required is actually vipassana. So these two types of meditation, they actually go together. So vipassana, what does this mean? So samatha means calming. Vipassana, it's typically translated as insight. So vipassana, so passana, that word means seeing, and vi means special. So vipassana, the technical translation would be it's a special way of seeing. So that kind of ties back into this notion of purifying one's distorted perceptions. You know, our perceptions are distorted by greed, hatred, and delusion. And as we purify those distortions, we are able to see more clearly. And when our seeing becomes completely purified, that is what this special seeing is pointing at. Special seeing, vipassana. So what is the self, right? Vipassana practice, it's pointing at something like that. This is not me, this I am not, this is not myself. If we take the opposite of that, this is mine. This I am, this is myself. That's actually pointing at Pema Chodron's The Perfect Room. That's just a way of being in the world that's completely self-centered. I am the most important thing in the world, and I'm going to get what I want and get away from what I don't want. And if you are preventing me from getting what I want, then that's a problem. So it's a very adversarial way of relating to our experience. So by reducing the self, it's actually doing this with our desires and our aversions, is to actually hold them less tightly, to begin to create some space around those, and to invite a different response to arise. So much like the fourth stage of the Metta-bhavana, where we bring a difficult person to mind, if we just dwell on how frustrating they are and how difficult they are, you can even feel that, just a shrinking down, a narrowing of the heart, of the body, of the mind, and then to actually open that up into something much more spacious. Right? So this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. So in regards to the difficult person, I like to ask myself this question. It's hard to ask when I'm actually in the throes of a frustrating conversation. I mean, when I'm reactive, I think it's probably true for all of us. It's hard to actually think clearly. So oftentimes this happens after the fact. Is I like to go back, like if I've had a difficult conversation with someone, I'll go back and I'll review that conversation, or I'll reflect on it. And I'll just ask myself this question. What am I defending? You know, why did I get so upset? Why is this so important to me? And there are certain things that are absolutely non-negotiable. They're important. You know, so for example, I really need people to treat me with respect. So if I'm not getting that in a relationship, I set boundaries around that. But oftentimes when I get bent out of shape, usually it's because I've got something in my head that I feel like I'm not getting which oftentimes kind of feels petty. They're unimportant things. So I can not take these things so personally. I can hold them less tightly, and I can begin this process of letting go. So then, in terms of the present situation, one path towards insight are called the Brahma-viharas. It's commonly translated as the divine abodes, the divine abidings. And there's four of them. And we actually did the first one when we started the evening with the metta-bhavana. Metta means loving kindness, universal loving kindness. Bhavana means cultivation of loving kindness. So the first Brahma-vihara is metta, or universal loving kindness. The second is karuna, or compassion. The third is sympathetic joy, mudita, or gladness. Gladness in the well-being of another person. And the fourth is upekkha, or equanimity. So loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. So the Buddha speaks about these four Brahma-viharas as a doorway into vipassana, into insight. So I'm going to speak about compassion. I'm going to first speak about metta, and then I'm going to speak about compassion. So metta, this word unconditional, to love another unconditionally, or loving kindness. So this word unconditional, it's a very big word, with neither judgment nor prejudice, without any bias. Unconditional. There's no judgment, there's no prejudice, there's no bias. And this is in relationship to other people. Unconditional well-wishing, unconditional benevolence towards all living beings, equally. Of course, that's what the metta-bhavana is cultivating. So then the other three Brahma-viharas are in close relationship to the first one of metta. So the second Brahma-vihara of compassion. So let me say one thing about the Brahma-viharas. In terms of metta to compassion, when we transition to compassion, it's not that metta goes away. Rather, metta is manifesting in a particular way in response to our present moment experience. So when metta meets the suffering of another person, and then the desire to relieve that person's suffering arises, this is what's referred to as compassion or karuna. So it's kind of interesting because the Buddha, he wasn't particularly clear about what he was pointing at with this word karuna. So here's one of the books that I've been revisiting, Compassion and Emptiness in Early Buddhist Meditation by Anālaya. And I'd like to just read to you the very first sentence from this book. I just find it amusing. Actually, it's the second sentence. The header is the nature of compassion. The early Buddhist discourses do not offer a succinct definition of the term compassion. The giving of precise definitions is a concern mainly of later literature, so that determining the meaning of a particular term in its early Buddhist usage often requires some interpretation. So what is compassion? Karuna, compassion, is the capacity for feeling what others are feeling. So calm, with, C-O-M is with, passion, to feel with another person, compassion, the capacity for feeling what others are feeling, or empathy. And then karuna, this Pali word, it's formed from the root kra, K-R. And this word comes from karoti, which means to do. So kra, this prefix for karuna, it means to do, to make. So it's an action, karuna. So we can glimpse a little bit of information from that. It suggests an active emotional response. So in terms of what it says in the Pali Canon, when the Brahmaviharas are mentioned, it will tend to speak about all four of them, first, metta, karuna, mudita, and upeka. And it will speak about them in terms of radiating these qualities outwards to include all beings. So I'll just read a line from the Pali Canon. Dwell with a heart of compassion. One should dwell suffusing one quarter, so too the second, so too the third, so too the fourth. Thus above, below, across, everywhere, and to everyone, as well as to oneself, one dwells suffusing all the world with compassion that is vast, grown great, immeasurable, without hate, without ill will. So to feel with another person, and then to actually act, to help another person to relieve their suffering. This is compassion in the world out there. Now let me make one distinction. There is a meditation called the Karuna Bhavana, the cultivation of compassion. And in a way it looks a lot like the Metta Bhavana. So in the Pali Canon, it does make a distinction between the four Brahmaviharas as meditation objects and the four Brahmaviharas as ways of being in the world. So there is that distinction made in the Pali Canon. So what I'd like to speak about is actually these Brahmaviharas in the actual world as a lived experience as we meet suffering in the world. So with regards to all that has arisen since the killing of George Floyd, racism, Black Lives Matter, all of that, white fragility. Well, I'll speak about my own experience. Is I have very few Black people in my circle of friends, and the few Black people that I do have in my circle of friends, I don't know that well. I'm on friendly terms, no doubt. Actually, they're friends. But I really don't know them that well. And with regards to their experience of being African Americans living in the United States, I really don't know what their experience is like, because I've never asked them. I've been reading stories from other African Americans about what their experience is like, and I've been watching videos about it, but I don't know their experience. So in terms of my ability to feel compassion for their racialized experience, their experience of being oppressed and marginalized to the extent that they are, I lack empathy because I have not been open to feeling what they are feeling with regards to being African American in this country. So I think this is another important thing about distorted perceptions. As I said earlier, our perceptions can be distorted by greed, hatred, and delusion. And what we tend to do is, the things that make us uncomfortable, we tend to push away. And if we keep doing this over and over and over again, it becomes habituated to the point where it becomes a habit, and we can even stop noticing that we're doing it. I mean, that's the nature of a habit. We may not even notice that it's happening. It becomes so ingrained in us. So I'm very struck by this notion of special seeing, vipassana, to see. to see another person's experience, to actually stand in their shoes, to really feel in our hearts what that experience is like, to empathy, and then to respond as best we can, actively in the world. So I think that's what we're being called to do. Yeah, so I'd like to just end this evening with I'll just read this Dr. Martin Luther King quote again, and then we'll call it a night. An individual has not started living until they can rise above the narrow confines of their individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of all humanity.